This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
I have a confession to make, one that is not easy to vocalize, one that is equally difficult to listen to. We are in trouble.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, and I have a message for you. Yes, we are in trouble. Last week we peered into the impending crash of the economy. It may dance on for a while using funny money from the Federal Reserve, but fall it will. A mere depression would be good news if the climate would only stay the same for humans and all creatures. But even during hard times, we will keep on dragging out more and more dirty fossil fuels out of the ground. It's a burning party, maybe a funeral pyre. Coming up, we'll talk it all through with emerging threats analyst and author Robert Marston Fanny. You'll also hear an interview with a top marine biologist from the UK. Alex Rogers is the co-lead author of the new State of the Oceans 2013 report. Alex reminds us that global warming is more a story of the oceans than our experience of floods and fires and storms on land. Most of our excess carbon is going into the sea, changing its chemistry, its temperature, and the basis of the food chain. The ocean is where it's happening, and the ocean is a news nowhere land where reporters don't go and humans don't care. Going through the emerging science, I'm also alarmed to discover big changes in Antarctica that can reshape our world. Climate change is like the many-headed hydra. We think we know it, but we don't. The Earth is rearranging in all the places humans don't look, at sea, at the poles, deep in the melting permafrost, and in the farthest forest and mountain tops. In our opening show this fall of 2013, climate scientist Paul Beckwith suggested warming could come very suddenly, even in a decade or two. I got some flack for that. A new paper by Morgan Schaller and James Wright of Rutgers finds, as Joe Rome writes, when CO2 levels doubled 55 million years ago, Earth may have warmed 9 degrees Fahrenheit in 13 years. It's a shocking example of what could happen. Business and political leaders have already announced they expect or will tolerate a doubling of CO2 levels from the pre-industrial level of 270 parts per million to over 600 parts per million. So we are planning on doubling the CO2 in the atmosphere. We are already on our way, touching 400 parts per million this year and adding more carbon faster every year as the fossil fuel party expands around the world. Canada, Australia, the UK, Europe, Brazil, and every country who can is promising to develop more fossil fuel resources. We're investing billions, possibly trillions of dollars and pounds into more mega coal mines, more fracked gas and liquid natural gas plants, bigger tar sands and shale oil projects. Humans seem intent on fossil suicide. Next week, we'll talk with Morgan Schaller, the author of that paper, to find out what can happen in a mere 13 years on this fragile planet. Look at it another way. A paper released this week says that by 2047, the coldest years will be hotter than the warmest years of the last two decades. We've already set new temperature records, and those will be the cold years we look back on. This paper was published in the journal Nature by a team of postgrads at the University of Hawaii, led by Dr. Camilo Mora. In an article by Justin Gillis of the New York Times, Dr. Mora says, quote, "Go back in your life to think about the hottest, most traumatic event you have ever experienced. What we're saying is that very soon, that event is going to become the norm." So do it. Remember the heat wave you prayed would end. The day the sun seemed to be the enemy, you waited impatiently for the cooler darkness. That's the new day in 2047. Just 34 years from now, how old will you be then? How about your kids or grandkids? Other scientists suggest a concerted effort to kick the fossil fuel habit. Going with reduced energy from renewable resources could delay that heating by at least 25 years. that's more precious time for humans to move away from the rising seas on the coast, to rethink the whole food supply system, to work out ways to survive the coming heat. We must at least give our children that time. The climate hydra pops out of this new paper again. I thought, and many scientists have suggested, that climate change would be less stressful around the equator. Most models say the extra heating will be the most extreme in temperate areas like North America and Europe and Scandinavia and Russia, and certainly closer to the poles. That's where we see the big news stories about storms and fires in the U.S. and Canada and Europe and Russia, plus those crazy heat waves developing around the Arctic and all the melting ice there. Dr. Morris says it only takes a small change in the tropics to create major damage. Why? Because the plants and animals there developed into a stable climate that doesn't change much during the year. They don't really know how to evolve and adapt. Even a degree or two of change, combined with some changes to the ocean or atmospheric currents, could bring down the rainforests, wreck the coral reefs, and cause mass extinction of species. The tropical plants and animals are less able to adapt. We simply haven't thought it through. Our unintentional geoengineering of the Earth has created a maze of cascading changes beyond our imagination. We're heading into a different world if we survive to see it. I'm asking for your help. I'm asking you to use every engine of communication. It's Facebook, it's Twitter, it's your blog, it's whatever you've got, and every link to every person you know. Go on a personal level. Raise the alarm. Join me in this pledge I make for Radio EcoShock. We're going to say it. We will speak the truth about what we are doing. Our political and corporate leadership is bankrupt and dangerous. They don't know what they are doing, or their short-term gain seems worth risking the whole future. And we let them, because we are comfortable and most of us are too well fed. Geared to hunt and migrate as a species, humans now have superpowers to travel and to kill. All of us have 1,000 energy slaves to service delicacies every day. We are addicted to fossil fuels, you know that. I don't know what 12-step program can break us out of this master complex. I don't know if we will survive the fossil trap, but we have to try. Nobody wants to hear this. Your friends and family and workmates don't. But honestly, when we add up the science and our own experiences in the real world, when we look at the unstable weather in the news, there is no choice but to speak up. Forget that envy of a better car or truck or house. Forget chasing paper wealth. Look at the young innocents around us and the other unknowing species, the other passengers on this planet. Even in small steps, whatever changes we can make in our own lives matters most. Whatever sign we can make, whatever we can do, matters now. Become a climate activist. Start with this.
I have a confession to make, one that is not easy to vocalize, one that is equally difficult to listen to. My confession is not one of a personal nature. I am not revealing my own petty individual sins. Instead, I'm making a confession for us all, a revelation of the ongoing and maturing tragedy of our race, one we will each need to be made aware of soon if we are to effectively act. For the age of excess is rapidly coming to a close, and we are now entering a difficult and hard to manage age of consequences. My confession is simply this. We are in trouble. A kind of trouble that is both typical to all living things and beyond the scope of anything we humans have yet witnessed. A kind of trouble that is both born of the natural world and caused directly by us. Our trouble is that over the course of the next century, we will run headlong into a number of very difficult to manage shocks that are the result of our unsustainable growth. How we confront these shocks will determine whether or not human civilization survives to reach the 22nd, 23rd, or 24th centuries, or whether we, at the very least, encounter a coming age of darkness and decline. that we will encounter some trouble is now unavoidable. At this point, all we can do is seek to reduce the scale of that trouble and lessen the harm that is its inevitable result. A decade or two ago, if we had acted sooner and with due urgency, we might have prevented harm, but harm is already upon us, growing worse with each passing year. And though our trouble has already become apparent to many, we still languish, squandering the time and effort needed to manage the emerging shocks, even as they grow more deadly and dangerous.
That is Robert Marston Fanny reading from the introduction to his new book, Growth Shock, Tragedy and Hope at the Limits of a Finite World. We'll get to the book, but to be honest, that isn't why I'm calling Robert today. He captured my undivided attention with his searing analysis into large-scale patterns of climate change based on real-time events happening around the world right now. That's in his blog called Robert Scribbler at WordPress.com. There it is, the scientific maps, the satellite shots of extreme weather events and danger brought together in ways we can all understand. Then Robert tops it off with analysis that I think raises whole new questions about our future together. Maybe that's Fanny's previous training as an intelligence analyst and years gathering scientific and technical assessments as editor for Jane's Information Group's Emerging Threats books, magazines, and electronic publications. But there's another side to Robert Fanny that helps him imagine the future. He's the author of the science fiction series Luthiel's Song, which attracts a cult following, including many artists who participate. You've heard a few snippets written for the book, Luthiel's Song, Dreams of a Ringed Veil, by multimedia artist Ethan Jackson, the music in our introduction. Robert Marston Fanny, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here, and I very much appreciate your generous introduction.
Well, you, Robert, were in the emerging threats analysis business for years, perhaps with nuclear annihilation and moving through resource depletion and much more. Lately, your blog, Robert Scribbler, seems mainly about climate change. Why is that?
Well, I believe that climate change is the primary, although not the only threat, but it is certainly the most pressing issue of the current day, in my opinion. And I believe that the pace at which climate change is beginning to ramp up and the intensity of the events that we are seeing at a local, regional, and global level are rising to a level where it should be a concern to us all.
Well, we could spend hours talking about just a few of your recent posts. Why don't we start with this one posted September 26, 2013, titled August 2013, Hottest Ocean Surface Temperatures on Record Defy ENSO, and we'll have to define ENSO, and Spur Continental Deluges. So I just went through one of those deluges, the heaviest rain I've ever seen in Vancouver, and that's saying something in 25 years on a rainy city. But before we connect that dot, what is happening with ocean temperatures?
It's best to think of the climate system as a system of atmosphere, which is the thin layer of air between the surface of the Earth and, you know, the top of the atmosphere, you know, the border of space. The surface of the ocean beneath the surface, and the cold that is trapped and locked into frozen water that we call ice sheets and glaciers. And the ocean surface, since the start of the Industrial Revolution, has been warming, and we have a record of this through the climate record, through various data that is collected by NASA, NOAA, and the world's oceanographic institutes. And over time, the ocean surface temperature increase has roughly mirrored that of the atmospheric temperature increase. Now, over the past decade, we have seen a switch in what is a periodic cycle of ocean warming and cooling, and this relates to your question about ENSO, from a positive phase of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation in which the eastern Pacific Ocean warms up, and it's such a large stretch of the eastern Pacific that it dumps a lot of heat into the atmosphere, and not only does it cause net cyclical warming of the oceans, but also net cyclical warming of the atmosphere. That happened to a large extent during the 1990s, and so we saw in combination with human-driven climate change, a natural cycle that drove global temperatures to be warmer. And in 1998, we had the hottest ocean and air surface temperatures that were then on record. And that was an outlier year because ocean warmed much faster than was typical. And because the ocean surface was dumping a lot of heat into the atmosphere warmed very rapidly as well. Since that time, and this is what's rather odd and why I've been writing about it, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation has flipped. It's gone from an El Nino state, which is the warm state of what we call INSO, to the La Nina state, which is a state where this large region of the eastern Pacific, the surface waters, are cool. And the reason why this happens is periodically you get upwelling from the deeper ocean. And so the cooler waters from the depths translate to the surface. These cooler waters contact the air. They cool the air above. And usually it has a net negative effect on both the ocean surface temperature and the atmospheric temperature. And so over the past 10 years, we have been in this negative phase. But despite this negative phase, we are still witnessing some of the hottest ocean surface and atmospheric temperatures on record, when we should, at the very least, see a dip of about 0.1 or 0.2 degrees Celsius in the average. And this is what is predicted by scientists, what is predicted by the IPCC during these oscillation years. And so, and one of the things that I think that the media hasn't really picked up on is that, and a lot of climate change deniers talk about how, oh, warming has slowed down. Well, warming should have slowed down. In fact, it probably should have stopped or even gone into the negative just a little bit, given what our current knowledge is of climate and human effect on climate. What has happened instead is we have had a slowing down of warming, but not a slowing down enough to prevent new record ocean surface and atmospheric temperatures. And in my understanding of the scientific literature, this is cause for concern because it shows that the Earth, the atmosphere, and ocean surface system is amplifying probably, and I'm sure there would be a lot of controversy over this, probably faster than the scientific consensus predicted. Now, in context to the article that I've written, I know I've given you a very long answer to a very short question. But in context, the August ocean surface temperatures worldwide were tied for the hottest on record in the global climate record. And this is significant because INSO, which is the periodic cycling between El Nino and La Nina in the eastern Pacific, is in the cool phase of neutral. And what this is showing is that eastern Pacific ocean surface temperatures, which generally govern the overall warmth and coolness of the oceans, are negative 1, negative 2 degrees Celsius below average. The rest of the ocean system is extraordinarily hot. This is outside of normal climate cycling. It's almost like as if you were driving a truck and you slammed on the brakes and you pulled off the brakes just a little bit, but you had the brakes still on, then the truck kept speeding up. And basically that's what's happened to the ocean system in August.
Okay, now how could hotter global oceans turn into extreme rainfall events all over the world?
Well, there's been a lot of research recently about the link between global warming and the rate at which water evaporates from both the surface of the ocean and the surface of the land and intensifies what is known as the hydrological cycle, the pace at which water enters the atmosphere and the pace at which water falls out of the atmosphere. And what scientists have found is that approximately for each 1 degree Celsius of temperature increase, you get 7 or 8% increase in the hydrological cycle, in the rate at which water is being evaporated from the land, enters the atmosphere, and the rate at which water falls out of the atmosphere in the form of rain back onto the land. And as a net effect, if you were just to paint with a broad brush over the entire surface of the Earth, what this generally means is that droughts are about 8% more intense, and major rainfall events are about 8% more intense. But you and I, or anyone who studies climate or meteorology, knows that the atmosphere is not even, that weather is intense more intense in certain areas, less intense in other areas. And so when you have an extreme event with when the hydrological cycle is amped up by 8%, you end up with more than an 8% increase in an extreme event, be it a drought or a major rainfall event. Now, in the case of the oceans, what we have found is that during years when the oceans have been near record warm, we are starting to see an oscillation in the rate of sea level rise. And there was an excellent article on the subject written by Joe Rahm entitled, I think it's entitled The Year the Oceans Fell. And of course, I'm going to have to check up on this and make sure I was correct. And what the article is about a number of studies that found that the rate of ocean surface temperature increase resulted in a massive amount of water evaporating from the surface of the ocean, so much so that it showed up in the sea level record. And so briefly, for about a one-year period, the sea level did not continue to rise at the 3 millimeter per year average rate that we've been observing, but it dropped. It dropped by about 2.5, 3 millimeters. And this was a record of the intensification of evaporation from the ocean surface due to heat. And this extra water ended up in the atmosphere. And what was also observed during that year were devastating floods. The Pakistan floods, a number of floods around the world. Australia, a few in the U.S., you know, a number in Asia. Just record floods. 100-year, 500-year, 1,000-year floods during the same period when we were seeing a very rapid rate of evaporation from the surface of the ocean, so much so as to temporarily drop sea level during a period when sea level was rising.
Right, and this year is another one of those. We've got Calgary, Colorado, we've got eastern China, and you've written in detail about the Russian flood disasters on the Amur River. Can you tell us about that just briefly?
Well, the Amur River floods were definitely an anomalous event, at least on the 120 or 30-year scale. Unfortunately, we don't have records going back beyond that. In this region of Russia, records began about 130 years ago, and this was the worst flood event ever recorded for that region. And what occurred regionally, if you look at it regionally, you know, region and global are linked in this respect, but regionally we had an extraordinarily powerful heat dome high pressure system over both China and the East China Sea and Japan and that region of the Pacific Ocean. And this pushed ocean surface temperatures extraordinarily high in that region, ranging between 3 and 4.5 degrees Celsius above normal on average. And this fed a major heat wave to the south of the Amur region, which pushed a lot of water vapor moisture into the atmosphere. The water vapor could not come down in that area because high pressures were too high, so it spilled out. And a lot of it got dumped into this, what appeared to be a monsoonal flow that was emerging over Asia, and it was linking monsoonal flows from India, Asia, and appeared to draw energy as well from the Arctic. And this available moisture rising up from the south, combined with a number of training events, what some meteorologists call rivers of moisture in the atmosphere, over the Amur region of China and Russia, dumped rain for, you know, days and days and weeks between late July and early August, and resulted in numerous cities just simply being inundated. Tens of thousands, at least, of, you know, homes just inundated. Whole cities had to be evacuated. And, you know, almost 1 million hectares of arable land flooded and resulting, you know, crops lost due to that single event in the Amur region, resulting both from localized heating of the ocean surface as well as this added amplification of the hydrological cycle.
Well, that's got to put Russian President Vladimir Putin, he flew there and demanded more action, but he's in a tough spot. His government arrested 14 Greenpeace activists and charged them with piracy as they were protesting Arctic drilling. You can't have it both ways. If your country, it practically burned down in 2010, Russia did, and now it's flooding, and yet they want to get more Arctic, more fossil fuels out of the far north. How can they keep going like that?
I honestly don't think that Russia, in a way, is in a very bad spot when it comes to climate change. It's funny because I know a number of assessments have said quite the opposite, that the north of Russia will become green and that will become one of the only regions in which, you know, we can provide, you know, agriculture. But if you look at the combination of sea level rise, thawing tundra, the increasing intensity and severity and modulation of these major rain and drought events, Russia's going to get hit very hard. This year, it's funny, 2010 was a very bad fire year for Russia, but we have seen very bad fire years for Russia for, 5 or 6 years running. This year was not a good fire year for Russia. It wasn't as bad as 2010, primarily because the fires that occur there, which were massive, occurred far to the north where very few people live. But if you look at the satellite shot, and we have a number of these listed on the blog, the burn scars are immense. Some of them 30, 40, 50 by 30 miles. The size of small states or extraordinarily large cities. And they're just all over this region that in Russia is called the Sea of Grass. But beneath all that is tundra that is thawing. And this is a volatile state for Russia because not only do they have the fuel, when it comes to forest fires, you need a few things, two of which are fuel and an ignition source. And what Russia has is not only fuel in the form of its grasslands and vast forests, but also fuel in the form of a thick layer of thawing tundra, which contains carbon in the form of organic carbon. Some of it's in a liquid form, what they call liquefied organic carbon. Some of it is in the form of methane. And when that thaws, all of that is exposed to the elements. And in some of these fires, what they're finding is that, from 1, 2, 3, even 4 feet beneath the surface, this land is burned. It's not just the trees that are burning, it's the land itself. So I don't know. If I were Vladimir Putin, I would not be comforted by these rather almost freakish fires that have been occurring on almost a yearly basis in their far north. Just because there aren't cities near there doesn't mean it doesn't affect them. Those regions are still productive for them, and if they are expected to be productive as the climate changes, this is certainly throwing a wrench in that notion.
Yeah, we get the same story here, in Canada. People are saying, well, we'll just all move to northern Canada and we'll grow our wheat there with the warmer climate. But I've been to northern Canada. Let me tell you, it's mostly rock and there's big lakes and it's not fertile soil by any means. So that's not going to happen. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with emerging threat analyst and sci-fi author Robert Marston Fanny. And you are aware that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, has just released a report which spurred the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine to jeer that climate change is just a pussy and not a tiger at all. What's your reaction to what we've seen so far of the early releases of this new IPCC report?
My personal opinion is that these news outlets really need to listen hard to the scientists. The scientists, number one, are extraordinarily conservative. If you took a layman like me and read the scientific reports, I have a decent understanding of the scientific reports because of my experience. But when I read the scientific reports, they, in many cases, pretty terrifying. And what you hear from the scientists are qualified, in many cases, reticent explanations of what is going on. And these scientists, they have large, usually in many cases, large research budgets or grants that require a degree of public support. And so when they produce these reports that come across as being very negative when it comes to climate change, they in many cases qualify the results. And in some cases, in the media, they sound almost like they're second-guessing themselves. In truth, they're just trying to cover their bases. If you're from NOAA or NASA and you have this major research grant, you're not going to want to come out and wave the flag, oh, the sky is falling. You're going to do your best to provide as much factual information as possible in a way that is reassuring so as to not result in a negative public response, for the most part. I read an article on this subject written by James Hansen about scientific reticence, which is certainly worth reading by anyone who's interested in the subject. But to these newspapers, I would say look at the meteorologists, look at the scientists who more and more often are becoming very concerned. One of the scientists currently, it was just an article out today, he's a meteorologist, and just declared, you know what? It's too risky. I am not going to use air travel anymore. I need to cut my carbon footprint. And he essentially, for all these meetings, he travels about 75,000 miles a year in an airplane, which results in around 150 tons of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere due to his consumption. And he says, you know what? It's not worth it. It's too dangerous. I can't keep flying. So where is the New York Times article about this scientist who is so concerned that he cannot keep flying? He is going to go out of his way to do video conferencing and go through the entire, you know, major inconvenience, in a way cutting off his access to what is a staple of Western lifestyle, in order to try and prevent something that he sees coming down the road.
Well, scientists like Michael Mann say the IPCC has dangerously lowballed the polar ice melt and rising seas, but they hardly touch on another possible planetary game changer, which you have called the methane monster. What does sea level rise or even tsunamis have to do with more methane into the atmosphere?
Well, there are a number of mechanisms that can release methane into the atmosphere. Recently, a scientific report was published investigating the issue of a link between sea level rise and methane release. And what they found was that as sea level rises, it creates additional pressure on underwater slope structures along the borders of continental shelves. And as this pressure increases, it increases the risk of what they call slope collapse. Now, most of the methane hydrates in the ocean are buried beneath many feet or many tens of feet of mud and sediment. And this cap protects them from a rapid release, you know, should ocean temperatures warm up in that region. Not only does it have to penetrate to the surface of the seabed, but also beneath the surface of the seabed to denature methane hydrates. And cause them to start to release. And then even after they denature, they have to find a pathway to reach the surface, get up through the water, and then get into the atmosphere. A number of scientists have poo-pooed the idea of rapid methane release by saying, well, there's really not much in the way of mechanisms that can release all these massive volumes of hydrates that are stored beneath this cap. Well, the recent paper shows that as sea level rises, the pressure increases on these slopes, and it greatly increases the risk of slope collapse, which uncovers the methane, exposes it to warmer seas, and can cause very rapid eruptions of methane from the seabed and to the surface of the ocean and into the atmosphere. It was found that during the last ice age and the end of the last ice age to the most recent, as sea level rose, there were a much greater number of these slope collapse events, on the order of about 10 times the normal rate, at least. And so the link between slope collapse and methane releases and tsunamis is that when slopes collapse underwater, it's like an earthquake. If you're familiar with the earthquakes that occurred in Indonesia, where you had these large rebound events that created very large tidal waves, slope collapse can create a similar situation, or depending on the volume of the material, something that is worse, because if you have many, many, many hundreds of cubic miles of rock that collapse, then the size of the related displacement of water is massive. And so not only does slope collapse increase the risk of methane release, which can very rapidly increase temperatures above and beyond what we're causing through human emission, but also can result in extraordinary large, potentially even mega tsunamis, occurring in regions that where we would not normally expect them.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. This is Radio EcoShock, and Robert Marston Fanny, we started out with a confession from your new book, Growth Shock. Would you tell us about that book?
Okay. I began writing Growth Shock about 9 years ago. I was not sure if I would ever publish it. It was more of a way for me to hedge my bets. I had began to receive a number of letters, emails, various scientific articles that people were asking me to read about the issues of human overpopulation and related overconsumption, human consumption of rapidly depleting and damaging resources, primarily fossil fuels, and related climate change. What Growth Shock does is it talks about the combination of these three aspects, overpopulation and overconsumption, resource depletion, and climate change as a combined shock to the human system. It reflects on earlier work, some of the work, for example, by by other authors. One of the primary works was one that was published in 1972 called The Limits to Growth, which I'm sure the ecologists in your audience are probably familiar with. It takes principles from those works and attempts to expand on them and generate real-world circumstances and scenarios and potential solutions related to those problems. As I wrote Growth Shock, the related problems became worse, especially climate change, which began to ramp up far more rapidly than the IPCC consensus assessment had predicted, especially when you start to look at not just warming, but changes in the Earth system, such as loss of ice sheets, loss of glaciers, the rate at which the deep ocean is warming, which has very bad ecological effects worldwide. At a point, I felt that it was timely and necessary to publish the work. In my opinion, I am uncertain how many people will read it, but I feel that I add my voice to a growing number who are making similar warnings, and I think the warning at this point must be made.
Well, how do people find out more about Growth Shock as a book?
Growth Shock is on Amazon, and it is currently only available in ebook form, but if you go to Amazon, you can read the first chapter or so. If it's something that interests you, you can purchase it. The proceeds, I am donating a portion of the proceeds, at least 50%, to 350.org, an organization that I feel has been very effective in both raising awareness and also providing political action to stop the exploitation of the worst resources, that being unconventional fossil fuels. So if you're still interested, you can take a look at robertscribbler.com, and there are a number of blogs on the issue of Growth Shock, and I'll be writing some more as we go.
Well, I would be remiss if we didn't check in with your alter ego, the lifetime obsession you have with science fiction writing. Can you just introduce us to Luthiel's Song, that series?
Well, Luthiel, as a fantasy character, is actually a metaphor for the Earth. The word that I use for Luthiel in the science fiction language that I used for the novel means water through stone, which is a metaphor. When I began writing Luthiel's Song, I wanted to both create a story that all people could enjoy, but also sprinkle it with a number of values that I thought were important as we go forward. And so the issues of veganism are brought up in the book, both me and my wife find to be very important, both from a sustainability aspect and a compassion aspect. The story itself is about a girl who is an orphan raised by elves, and on her 15th birthday is chosen to be a blood tithe to these terrible creatures called Vural who feed on the blood of elves. And so she ends up becoming a blood tithe, a sacrifice to these terrible creatures. And it's about her adventure into the heart of darkness.
And your next book, is it coming out or already out, is going to be called The Death of Winter?
Yes. The third book is not out yet, but I am currently working on that. And it will be called The Death of Winter. And that ties into a number of issues that I feel are both current and worth exploring in a science fiction apocalyptic or ongoing apocalyptic setting. The concept of The Death of Winter is that there is this aspect of the world, the fantasy science fiction world of Luthiel's Song, in which there is a spirit called First Frost, and without First Frost, the world will burn. And so it is about an assault of the forces of heat and fire and the related forces of greed and empire on this idealized substance that I call First Frost and the threat that its loss presents.
Well, getting back to the real world, so to speak, although I think you're still touching on the real world and what you write there, but Robert Fanny, what are you working on next when it comes to emerging threats?
Well, as far as future projects, I think that currently the most interesting and terrifying aspect of climate change is the rate at which we are losing our ice worldwide and how that affects, you know, us as a civilization, as a species, and as a global system. And I think that one of the things the scientists really need to take a look at is what happens when a world such as ours moves from a glacial state to a hothouse state. We've done a lot of research about periods of time when it was very warm and it became much warmer. And this happened about 50 million years ago in an event called the PETM that James Hansen has written a lot about and written some very interesting work on. and has compared it to what could happen now in a not an absolute worst case, but a near worst case scenario. But back then there were no glaciers. And the physical change from glaciers to water have impacts on the Earth system that are unique. And the last time an event such as this happened was 250 million years ago, approximately, during the various Permian extinction events, where there was a glaciated world which slowly transitioned to a hothouse world. And I do not know. I mean, there are a number of scientific papers that hint at what could happen as a result, including ocean stratification, or what they call a Canfield ocean state, due to a combination of ocean warming, but also stratification as a result of a sudden influx of fresh water on the surface, which essentially kills off the oceans and can result in devastating effects to land masses long term, or life on land long term. So what we are seeing now, and the reason why I think we should ask this question, is that the pace at which we are adding greenhouse gas forcing to the Earth system is six times as rapid as any time ever seen in geological history. We have, you know, massive stores of methane locked in both ice and ocean systems, and we have ice. What happens if that changes, and what happens if it changes rapidly? And so that's what my next work will explore.
As you say, we are in trouble. It takes imagination and the ability to interpret science to forecast possible futures. And Robert Marston Fanny is one of those fortunate combinations, and I think he helps us see through the fog. You can find his blog at robertscribbler.wordpress.com. And I have links to Robert's articles and books coming up in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Robert Fanny, thank you for that illuminating blog. I mean that. And I hope to have you back again on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, sir. It was fantastic talking to you, and I would be more than happy to come back.
I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. We humans have always believed the sea is so vast we can't seriously damage it. A new report warns this isn't so. It's called The State of the Ocean 2013 Perils, Prognoses, and Proposals. We've reached one of the lead authors, Professor Alex Rogers of Somerville College, Oxford, and Scientific Director of IPSO, the International Program on the State of the Ocean. Dr. Rogers, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much.
The subhead of the press release says, greater, faster, closer. Should we be worried about the state of the oceans overall?
Absolutely. We know that over the past 50 years, the oceans have been under increasing stress from overfishing, destructive fishing practices, and pollution. But over this time, climate change effects have also been slowly creeping in. So, for example, the oceans have absorbed something like 90% of the heat coming from the effects of greenhouse gases on atmospheric warming. So the ocean's been getting warmer. They've also been getting more acidic as a result of taking up carbon dioxide.
The United Nations latest climate report concludes that most of our carbon pollution is falling into the oceans rather than the land. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. The oceans perform this marvelous service for us by taking up something like one-third of the carbon dioxide that we're emitting every year. Unfortunately, the side effect of that is that carbon dioxide reacts with seawater to produce carbonic acid, and that is reducing the amount of calcium carbonate in seawater, which many marine organisms use to build their skeletons from or their shells.
You talk about a deadly trio of stressors we are imposing on the sea. The first is deoxygenation. Many of us have the impression dead zones are just a problem around a few river deltas. Is that true?
Dead zones are certainly a coastal phenomena, but what we've seen in the wider ocean is an increase in the extent of what are called oxygen minimum zones. So this is a zone found around all of the oceans where oxygen naturally reaches a lower concentration than nearer the surface as a result of bacterial breakdown of organic matter sinking out from surface waters. These dead zones are expanding because of the effects of warming of the ocean, which decreases the mixing of the oceans vertically and also decreases the amount of oxygen that seawater can hold. We've already seen that this is compressing the habitat of large marine fish like marlin, which need high oxygen concentrations to maintain their very high metabolic rates.
You've also said that perhaps this will happen more in some areas of the North Pacific and especially in tropical seas. Why those areas, and how could global warming cause that?
Well, those areas already naturally have lower concentrations of oxygen associated with them. And as I said, one of the effects of the sea warming is that it can hold less oxygen. So naturally there are low oxygen concentrations in warmer water. This is one reason why, for example, some Antarctic animals, which live in very, very cold water, can reach a giant size compared to their warmer water relatives.
And next up on your list is ocean acidification. It's a huge topic, I know, but can you just give us an introduction to what some of the worries are there?
Yes, ocean acidification has been nicknamed climate change's evil twin, in that it's something that we weren't really that aware of. Everyone was aware of the fact that the oceans were warming, and that has major consequences in terms of causing things like mass coral bleaching. But acidification is actually caused by carbon dioxide dissolving into seawater. And this produces carbonic acid, which then alters the natural carbonate equilibrium in seawater. What this means for marine animals that grow shells or skeletons from calcium carbonate is that their growth rates are reduced, or their shells or skeletons are actually changed in structure. They become weaker. But also, as research is continuing, more and more effects of acidification are being found. So, for example, it's been discovered that acidification affects the ability of marine animals to smell. So if acidification continues, we may see effects like larval reefish unable to find their habitats to settle on and then grow up into adults because they can no longer perceive their environment in the way that they can in the present day.
And then you report warming itself can damage the ocean. I wonder how that can work and how serious a problem that is.
This is certainly something which already is having a pervasive effect on marine life. So many people think of climate change as something which will cause impacts in the future. But we know that since 1979, for example, when we saw the first mass coral bleaching events, that the oceans have already passed, if you like, a tipping point. Mass coral bleaching occurs when the oceans warm up and temperatures get too high and the corals eject symbiotic microscopic algae that they rely on for their energy and their nutrients, and the corals then die. One of these warming events in 1997-1998 killed 16% of the world's coral reefs. We also see all over the world now poleward shifts in the distribution of marine life as a response to warming temperatures, changes in the timing of biological events in the ocean, and shifts in the structure of entire ecosystems as species move to try and keep pace with favorable temperatures that they like to live in.
The international community has suggested that 2 degrees is the limit of global atmospheric warming that we shouldn't pass. Are there similar lines we can set for the ocean heating?
Well, in our view, 2 degrees is probably already too high for marine ecosystems like coral reefs. And if anything, we should be trying to reduce those targets. The way things are going at the moment, it's unlikely that we'll actually meet that 2-degree target. It's more likely that we'll actually overshoot those targets. And that is going to have catastrophic consequences for marine ecosystems particularly very sensitive ones like coral reefs. And we must remember here that these are the most diverse marine ecosystems on Earth. They also produce huge socio-economic services for humankind in parts of the world where those coral reefs occur. So there are direct economic consequences of these impacts.
This is Alex Smith. I'm talking with Oxford marine biologist Alex Rogers on a new report about the state of the oceans. We've heard recently that a warming ocean has disrupted the hydrological cycle. Very warm seas appear to be linked with extreme rainfall events or more violent storms. Is that theory or is there solid science behind that?
I mean, this is slightly out of my area of expertise because I'm a marine biologist, but it's certainly the case that greater heat stored up in the oceans can result when that's combined with natural environmental cycles in these extreme weather events. So, for example, it's been found that the oceans periodically appear to dump their heat during what are called El Niño events, and those events are coupled with very, very heavy rainfall, particularly in areas like South America, but their effects are felt over a much, much wider area.
Alex Rogers, we're also demolishing ocean life by overfishing. In Canada, the historic cod fishery was killed off. And this is going on all around the world, and it's almost unreported. What did you find?
Well, this is a very interesting area because there's been a raging debate between scientists on whether the management of fisheries are improving or getting worse. And it would seem that looking at the evidence as a whole, some fisheries are improving in their state, but those fisheries are mainly around the developed nations, places like Europe, the United States and Canada, where there is a large infrastructure to support that fisheries management. Elsewhere in the world, and we're talking about something like 80% of world fisheries, the news is not so good. And in fact, overall, yields from fishing are declining globally as a result of this mismanagement.
Despite all that you've said, I know there are some people who will be asking this obvious question. We live on land after all. Why do we have to act to save the oceans? It's a huge question, but what do you think?
Well, the more work I do on the oceans and the services they provide for humankind and indeed for the entire Earth's life support system, the more I'm convinced that we should be very serious about maintaining their diversity and their function. Life in the oceans plays a pivotal role in the big biogeochemical cycles that maintain conditions on Earth as we've known them throughout the course of human evolution and beyond. Essentially, these climate change effects are causing changes to the way that life is structured, and we can expect as a result major changes in terms of ecosystem function. One of these, as I said, is the fact that the oceans take up large amounts of carbon dioxide, and we're very concerned that some of the impacts of climate change will actually feed back through the oceans and reduce the ocean's capacity to take up that carbon dioxide, with the obvious result that global warming will accelerate.
When we talk about solutions, I have to wonder, can we really separate the ocean from the atmosphere? Aren't they part of one system?
Insofar as greenhouse gas emissions are concerned, they are part of one system. And this is a very important thing to bear in mind. We often forget about the oceans as part of that system. The simple fact is that emissions have to be reduced. Otherwise, we're going to be faced with these major problems that are discussed in the IPSO papers. And these problems are creeping up on us very, very quickly. The rate of carbon dioxide change in the atmosphere is probably as great or greater than has been seen at any time over the last 300 million years. So we're talking about a very, very significant event and really a one-off experiment that we're performing with the Earth's atmosphere and therefore with the oceans and indeed with the entire biosphere.
And I want to ask Professor Rogers, solutions for overfishing have been proposed for decades. Are there any signs of sanity when it comes to regulating the fishing industry worldwide?
As I said, there have been some really good initiatives in reducing overfishing around the coastal waters of developed states. That's not the case in many other parts of the world. And the really crazy thing here is that actually we know the answers to solving this problem. There are too many fishing vessels out in the oceans fishing the stocks that are there. Fishing fleets are subsidized to continue to fish when they're no longer profitable and when the fish stocks they're targeting are in decline. Also, there's a large area of the oceans, which we call the high seas, which lie beyond national waters, which are very poorly regulated with regards to fishing. So it's a really urgent matter that we get new governance arrangements for the high seas that improve our ability to manage human activities. Here we're talking about fishing, but there are also many other activities which take place out on the oceans to make those activities more sustainable and to really improve the supply of fish.
Where will the new report be published, and where can my listeners find out more on the web?
Well, IPSO has a website which is available at www.stateoftheocean.org. That's State of the Ocean is all one word. The papers that report these findings have been published in the journal Marine Pollution Bulletin. These papers will be available for 6 months for readers to download free of charge.
As we finish up, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think the thing to add here is that many people are not aware of the problems that we face in the oceans and are not aware of how those problems are connected with the issue of climate change. So I'd really, really recommend that your listeners really go out there and find out for themselves what the issues are that we're facing.
Our guest has been marine biologist Alex Rogers. He is a professor of conservation biology at the University of Oxford and a fellow of Somerville College, along with co-lead author Professor Dan LaFolie and many other expert scientists. Dr. Rogers has released a major new report titled The State of the Ocean 2013, Perils, Prognoses, and Proposals. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock. That's it this week for Radio Activism. Download our past programs and help the cause at our website, ecoshock.org. The blog is at ecoshock.info. Next week, the climate scientists speak freely. Our opening music was Dance, live at the Labyrinth Shambhala Music Festival 2011. That will take us out.
Radio EcoShock.